Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings and welcome to Mount Olympus. I am Hercules Invictus. Before we get to tonight's program, I have a very quick review and a quicker announcement to make. We're continuing our review with spoilers of BBC's Atlantis. We're up to season 1, episode 2, A Girl by Any Other Name. Jason discovers that he's originally from Atlantis and that he has a destiny. While seeking answers, he rescues Medusa from Maenads and Satyrs. Though freed, she is cursed by a dying Maenad. And our announcement, Nicholas Dyack has his new weekly roundup of news on his website at www.nickdyack.com. Included is a review and an interview of the author of the SPQR comic. And now onward to retro sci-fi and horror cinema with Brian Walker of Brian's Driving Theater. Greetings, Brian. How are you?
I'm well tonight, Hercules. How are you this evening?
I'm also doing well. Keeping busy.
Well, great. Same here. And what I'd like to talk about tonight, since last month in March, I rained on the parades of a few select science fiction series of films. This month, I wanted to get back to some praise and talk about some films from a particular horror studio that I really like. And that's actually Hammer Films. The British production company, which I'd like to say they were unparalleled, and they were, but they did have a rival out there in the 60s and 70s called Amicus, and I like a lot of the Amicus horror movies too. I didn't come to love Hammer Films until a little later in my existence. I got to tell you, when I was a kid, I'd get excited if I saw, a Frankenstein movie was coming on, and when I would tune in at, whatever obscene hour it was, midnight or whenever, sometimes I'd feel a little let down if it was a Hammer film. And I got to tell you, though, after watching them, I changed my tune a little bit. You know, the Universal monster movies were such a natural for me. And the Hammer, and those are the first ones I saw. So, and as you know, I don't like change a whole lot, and I don't like remakes, typically. So it took me a little longer in life to warm up to the Hammer films, but I really love them for a number of different reasons. And I thought that's what we would talk about tonight.
That is awesome. I, too, have very high opinion of the Hammer films. And I, too, started off with Universal Monsters and then found my way into Hammerland. And it's a great place to visit and to keep visiting.
Well, and some of the films that I can remember my parents taking me to in the early 70s were Hammer films. And I guess I just didn't put two and two together. Seeing them on screen is always a little different. When it translates to TV, especially back then, screens were much smaller. You've mentioned on a number of occasions that your parents had a black and white set, yeah, not a color set. I mean, that was another thing that you didn't really care at the time, but the image, it was so different. And I think that probably was another stumbling block for me and Hammer. Hammer's films, I mean, say what you will about the plot and the plottiness of it, but they're really well shot. The cinematography is top-notch, and you can tell where they've cut some corners, when it comes to sets and things like that. But where the money really counts, and I guess I should say, the talent and the cinematography, they really go all out. Everybody does something on a dime, and Hammer's films, especially some of their earlier horror films, were done, on the lean side of things. But there are a lot of fun to watch. And I know that some people think that, it's a British movie. British movies are really talky. There's never anything truly genuinely scary about them. Well, that's not really the case. I can think of a number of Hammer films that have given me every bit, the number of chills running up and down my spine as the Universal movies.
Yeah, I can say the same. And the Universal movies kind of like were the foundation, and then Hammer built on them. And as I pointed out in other shows, in the beginning, I couldn't really differentiate. You know, I could recognize the character, but I didn't really get the concept that different actors were portraying the character. So it all tended mm-hmm. to blend together. So through the Hammer films, I learned that Dracula cannot die, ever, regardless of what happens to him.
That is true. No matter what, he's going to be back for the next movies.
And as long as you had those Tanya leaves, the mummy was coming back too. And somebody who always was digging up those Tanya leaves.
I was trying to think today if I have a favorite, and I'll go it for our benefit. I'll just call them Universal Monster movies. I love Dracula. I love the original, you know, Frankenstein, which is I have vivid memories of seeing the original Frankenstein movie. The first time I was probably 7 or 8 years old, and it was one of those late night movies that didn't run until after the local news. You mm-hmm. know, so you were already making an investment, you know, in staying up really late, and it terrified me. I think I watched it through my fingers the whole night. You know, every time Boris Karloff got any screen time, or if they came in close, you know, even on my parents', you know, Zenith TV, you know, it was still pretty chilling. It was pretty terrifying. And, you know, the sets are wonderful on the Universal movies. The atmosphere that the set dressers set up for a movie like Frankenstein is really tough. It's really hard to top something like that.
Right.
And the first Frankenstein movie that Hammer did was actually their first color movie. Hammer, you know, was a, you know, things were kind of rough in the UK as you know, after the end of World War II. You know, money was pretty tight, you know, all across the country. So everything was done, you know, to a price and, you know, on the cheap. I mean, not made cheaply or anything like that, but you could tell where they spent the money. And actors over there did not make the money that actors in the U.S. made at the same time. There was just no comparison. And, you know, for The Curse of Frankenstein, and that's Christopher Lee, you know, in the role of Frankenstein. I mean, he made just like a few hundred bucks, you know, doing the film, and enough to keep you going for, you know, how many ever weeks, you know, just kind of a workaday kind of guy, you know, and he did make, you know, tons and tons of movies and a very good actor. I don't know if you've ever seen The Curse of Frankenstein, because it's the only Frankenstein movie that Christopher Lee portrays the monster. And the first time I watched it, I'm sorry.
I probably have at some point. My childhood are saturated with monster movies, so I probably have seen it at some point.
Oh, I'm sure. It's on TV even today. You know, and the movie's 64 years old. It's still, you know, pretty accessible. As a matter of fact, I think there's a version of it on my DVR right now, to tell you the truth. But it was Hammer's first color film, and going back and watching some pieces of it earlier today, I was really struck by how beautifully it's shot. You know, it's Hammer's first movie, or first color movie, I should say, even though the studio had been around since the mid-30s. But whoever shot it did a great job with the color. And I would think that would be really tough from switching over from just all black and white mm-hmm. to color, you know, in terms of lighting and how to dress the set and such. But it's really striking. They use the color very effectively. And I mean, they tone down the reds so that it's pretty tasteful, you know, in its goriness, which I find kind of interesting and, you know, very British, really, if you think about it. But I think the thing, you know, I remember the first time I watched that movie, The Curse of Frankenstein, and I was probably, I don't know, 12 to 13, 14 years old, you know, tween to early teens. And I was really put off, by Christopher Lee's makeup in the movie. I don't know if you remember what his Frankenstein looked like, but it was very different from the, you know, the James Whale designed, you know, Frankenstein, the Boris Karloff Frankenstein that we've all, you know, come to associate, you know, with that mental image. If you think about trying to conjure a mental image out of, you know, Mary Wollstonecraft Shelley's book, which was written in the early part of the 19th century, there are lots of different ways that you can go with it. But if you've ever read the book, her description of the monster, it's not that it's bad or anything, but it could be interpreted a million different ways, you know. And James Whale's interpretation of it, it's the one that sticks. These days, you whenever you think of the character of the Frankenstein monster, Boris Karloff is what leaps to mind.
Mm-hmm.
And I see why Hammer went in a different direction. They were probably a little afraid of copyright infringement, quite honestly. But they didn't go for the, you know, the menacing, you know, flat-headed, sinister-looking monster. The way the monster is portrayed in the original, the 1931 version. If you watch the original Frankenstein and then compare Boris Karloff's makeup in The Bride of Frankenstein, they have softened him up quite a bit.
Yes.
Made him look more human, maybe a little more sympathetic. Although he is a sympathetic character in the first one, he's just so terrifying to look at that nobody can really see past it.
I Googled
except for Gene Hackman, except for Gene Hackman and Young Frankenstein, perhaps.
I Googled Lee Frankenstein, so I have an image now. Yeah, I've seen
it. Okay, and yeah, if you look at his image in the two movies, they really softened the makeup. And that could have been a result of the Hays Code, too. Who knows? You know, they regulated everything that the public consumed back then. And that might have been a stipulation that they might have had to have softened him up a little bit, or to make him more appealing to, you know, also Lanchester, the Bride of Frankenstein. But in the Hammer version, The Curse of Frankenstein with Christopher Lee, he looks more like an accident victim. He doesn't he doesn't really look sinister or anything. I mean, he just looks banged up. I mean, he's got an eye that's really cloudy, and he's got, of course, scars everywhere. But he's menacing in what he does in the movie. And Christopher, I'm certainly not bashing Christopher Lee. I mean, I think he was a fantastic actor and could do so many different things. And he's good in The Curse of Frankenstein. But the makeup just, the Boris Karloff image is so indelible for me that it took me a while to get past that. And when watching the Hammer Frankenstein entries, but I appreciate them now for what they are. And I mean, you really can't go wrong with Peter Cushing. I mean, he was in practically every one of those movies, and he adds this air of sophistication. And you know, if Peter Cushing's in it, it's not going to be a bad movie. It might be mediocre, okay, but he's not going to be mediocre in it. I mean, he's going to turn in a great performer, always watchable, really good at wringing sympathy out of some wretched characters, too. I mean, not, you know, sometimes he's an avuncular scientist or something like that, but most often there's really something sinister to him. In such a mild-mannered looking man, and he does it really well. He can milk it, especially at the end of the movie where he has to atone, you know, for his sins. He can milk it for all it's worth. He's really good at it. And you know, he can tug at the heartstrings too. He can mm-hmm. take somebody disgusting and make that character just a little sympathetic, so you feel bad about it at the end of the movie. I mean, he was a really terrific actor. And, you know, when you think about horror films and who's in the cast, obviously, you know, Karloff and Lugosi, they always come to mind. But for me and my, you know, very healthy appreciation for Hammer films, I also think of Christopher Lee and Peter Cushing, because they starred in way more of those films than, you know, the originals that we remember, you know, from the Universal series. I mean, Boris Karloff was the monster, I think, three times. You know, and after 1939, he wasn't the monster anymore. He was usually playing, you know, the evil mad scientist. Mm-hmm. After that. And it, you know, those were physically demanding roles. I mean, for Karloff in the original movie, he was padded and wore these, you know, big lifted heavy shoes hamstrung physically in so many different ways. And I think his costume weighed around 40 pounds or so. And he was most people back then were just skinny people. You know, they weren't, you know, overly muscular. Food wasn't exactly plentiful, you know, at some times, you know, in the past. And in order to make him look bigger, to make him look more menacing, they had to add a lot of weight to him.
I'd heard that.
And, you know, when you think about, you know, Boris Karloff was roughly about my height. I think he was about 6 feet tall. That's another interesting thing about Christopher Lee when he does get to portray the monster. He was a tall man. He was about 6'5". And you know, very trim, you know, slender. I thought that his stature, you know, his height and, you know, his build really lent itself better to the Dracula series of films that Hammer made. And as a matter of fact, you know, like I said a few minutes ago, Christopher Lee only had one turn as Frankenstein.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, when he made his first Dracula film, and I believe 1958, I think that was just kind of it for him. He was such a good Dracula. And I got to say, even as a child watching the Hammer Dracula films, if it was Christopher Lee, I was going to stick with it. I really appreciated him as Dracula. Going back and watching his performance as Frankenstein, he's excellent in it. He's very good. I had trouble with the buy-in on the makeup job, which is not, I mean, obviously it doesn't impact his performance at all. And maybe they softened his makeup or not softened it, but made him look more tragic. Maybe that's the direction I'm trying to head with how his makeup is done in The Curse of Frankenstein. He just looks, like I said, banged up, like he's been in a horrific accident and then somebody reanimated him, unfortunately. Just not a great look. And, you know, for me, when I think of Dracula, I actually think of several actors. But when the image that pops up in my mind when I think of Frankenstein, it's always Boris Karloff.
Me too.
Yeah, I mean, just nobody else comes to mind. And a lot of other actors have portrayed the monster and done it very well. I have this actor, Glenn Strange, profiled on my website, and he made a lot of Westerns. And actually wound up on Gunsmoke for the remainder of his career until he died in the early 70s. But in the 40s, he was a big, strong, imposing man, and somebody decided that he would make a good Frankenstein, and he did. He looks fantastic. He's got the build for it as well. You can tell that he didn't require, you know, all the padding that somebody, you know, like somebody, you know, slim like Boris Karloff would have needed. And he makes a fantastic Frankenstein in the 40s Universal Frankenstein films. He's really good at it. And I think, you know, that's another, you know, unsung character actor, I guess I should say, would be Glenn Strange. I think he gets overlooked in the pantheon, you know, of horror films. And it's really a shame because when you watch his films, and sometimes they weren't written, you know, as well as some of the earlier ones were, although the production values were still pretty good. He does a great job in it. And, you know, one of the things that I like about working with B-movies is sort of celebrating, you know, the unsung actor, maybe the unsung director, you know, somebody who did really good work throughout their career and just didn't get enough appreciation out of it. That's really the whole sentiment behind the drive-in.
Very true. And they accomplished something that we're not really recognizing as an accomplishment until now. They had the first shared universes, where they had all these different movies that took place in the same universe. You can cross back and forth. and they had characters, you know, that they used, that they, you know, put in other films and teamed up together. And now we recognize the power of that in the MCU with the Marvel superhero movies. But that's actually very old. The Hammer universe was self-contained. The Universal universe was self-contained. You know, and all of these things took place in the same universe.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And, you know, when you think about, you know, let's say a really strong visual character like Dracula, after a while, after you've seen, you know, so many different interpretations of it, it does all start to blend. You know, it does become, a, you know, as you said, a, you know, sort of a community. But with other, you know, characters, you know, depending on the portrayal, the one that, you know, you brought the character to light or made it or made the character famous, you know, as with the Karloff Frankenstein, you just can't shake him from it. You know, it's just so hard to do. And even though I think Bela Lugosi was a fantastic actor, I do see other actors in the role of Dracula, and particularly Christopher Lee, because he played the role so many times, you know, but from the 50s into the 70s. And, you know, Hammer, you know, they had to make movies to survive. They weren't a big production company like Universal, you know, became, or Warner Brothers or something like that. It was a small, struggling company for a long time. And you know, prior to The Curse of Frankenstein, and well, before it, the Quatermass experiment, which was their first horror film that they did with Brian Donlevy, which is actually another really good movie, honestly. They had done, you know, comedies and dramas and things like that that, you know, I guess kept the lights on, you know, in the studio. But, you know, weren't great for international distribution. But when they latched into horror in the late 50s and came up with the idea of, you know, doing the old Universal, you know, horror monster characters, but in color, it really put them on the map, and it made them tons of money. They spent very little, relatively speaking, on The Curse of Frankenstein. The budget for it translated into about $90,000 or so, and that was in 1957.
Wow.
Well, if you look up what the production of the original Frankenstein, the Universal Frankenstein, cost, it was close to $300,000, and that was in 1931 Depression era dollars, where your money really stretched, you know. So, I mean, that tells you that, you know, even, you know, 25 years or more after, you know, that Depression era Frankenstein, Hammer had to turn this, you know, out on a dime, and only spent $90,000 on it. And it's a color film, which ate up a lot of the money.
Yeah.
In the production of it. And if you watch the movie, the sets are really small. I mean, you, in the original Frankenstein film, you know, Frankenstein's lab is a massive set, and it's beautifully dressed. I mean, that's where a lot of that money went. It had to have been for the laboratory, because in the original movie, that lab is just fantastic. There's a representation of it in an attraction at Universal Studios Hollywood, and it's called Universal Monsters. If you're ever in Southern California, specifically Burbank, and you get to go to Universal, and it's supposed to reopen here again pretty soon from what I understand, go to the Universal Monsters exhibit. It is mind-blowing. They have the entire Frankenstein lab set in there, and it looks like it's to scale. We haven't been for probably 10 years or more, but you can, my partner had to drag me out of there. I just started standing and staring. I was like, wow, this is just amazing. Really beautiful set. You don't get that, unfortunately, in Curse of Frankenstein. You can tell that the actors are kind of confined by, you know, the walls and the set and the furniture placement and such. And a lot of it is shot really close up too, which is done well, but it's also done so you don't have to dress so much of the set.
The Hammer films also, if I recall correctly, they featured some nudity too, or some risque type of shots that didn't make it to the black and white TV when they were shown on television.
Well,
but the first
well,
time
in,
I caught,
in early. I'm sorry.
No, when I first caught the entirety of the movies, I was very much surprised by how much they had cut out on television.
Well, but, you know, with Hammer, you know, since they did make movies for an international market and Americans then and maybe even now, I think, are a little more prudish than, you know, people on the continent might be. You know, there were certain societal norms, things that you could, you know, show in, let's say, France or Germany that just wouldn't fly in America back then. You know, and one of those would have been nudity. And you would have also cut a chunk out of the market, too. You know, teenagers were the ones who were keeping those movies going, especially in the early to mid-60s. And if you, you know, exposed a breast or something like that, you were going to wipe out your audience. You didn't really see that in the American versions as much. Not until, you know... the MPAA was formed in, let's say, 68. But even then, you know, you probably weren't going to see a whole lot until you got into the 70s. I can remember my parents taking me to see movies as a child that I probably shouldn't have seen. I'm not saying they were horrible parents or anything like that.
No.
But remember, when you would go to the drive-in, I think your parents were kind of counting on you falling asleep after the first feature.
Sure.
And then the second feature was always the racier of the two. You know, if there were, let's say that the two films were PG and R, well, the R was going to be shown second. And I could usually stay up, especially if it was something, you know, a little racy or particularly horrifying or something like that. I always made it I could usually stay awake through the second, the R-rated feature, and that's why I say I probably saw some movies that I shouldn't have. And I don't think it desensitized me to anything. I think it probably, you know, made me more aware of, you know, some of the uglier things that might possibly happen, you know, out there, you know, in the world. I can remember seeing Alfred Hitchcock's Frenzy. When I was, I probably was 7 or 8 years old. It was early 70s. And we saw it at the drive-in, and it is just incredibly violent. I mean, it may be one of the most violent movies I've ever seen, truly. And I like Sam Peckinpah films, so, I mean, you know, consider that for a minute. And, you know, I probably shouldn't have seen that movie at that age, but I have vivid memories of seeing it. I can probably, you know, recount watching most of it just because it made such an impression on me as a kid. I just couldn't believe the violence. And I had seen other Alfred Hitchcock films, you know, on TV, and they'd been, you know, spooky or at least charming, you know, in the way they were done. And that was just, woo, you know, I mean, it was grim and brutal. Yeah, brutal. I think that, as my partner would say, I think that's probably the best way to put it.
With me, when I was 11, I had a beard and a mustache, and I was almost my full height. So I got to watch all those movies because people, you know, I looked much, much older. So I had no problem as passing, you know, as 18 or whatever the age was to be led into these movies. So in Washington Heights, which is near and then in where I lived during that time, there were a plethora of movie theaters, 3 of them within walking distance from each other. So I got to enjoy a lot of those movies, you know, without being caught and put on television. I remember the biggest shock was I had seen Diary of a Mad Housewife in the movies.
Yeah.
Then when they were going to put on TV, I was wondering, how can they possibly show this on TV? So, of course, I had to stay up and see. And they cut out so much that the movie seemed to be inside the mind of an insane person. And that's what, it made no sense at all, you know, the way they cut it together and put it on television.
Well, but you know, Carrie Snodgrass in that movie, and I'm very familiar. That's one of my mom's favorite movies, and she took me to see it when I was a kid. I understood none of it. You know, at that age, I mean, I was just, what the hell is this? You know, I had no idea. But she's the only person in the film who is sane.
Mm-hmm.
It's every you know, she's the only sane one in a world, you know, her world with her kids, and Richard Benjamin is her husband, and you know, the phony group of people that they run around with, consort with. She's the only normal, grounded, sane person, but she's the one who is being classified as insane. I think it's a brilliant movie. It is it's so well done. Yeah. And really lost on a 6-year-old viewer.
Well, I got it in the movies. I was a bit older than I'm 62, so I think I'm a decade or so older than you.
No, not quite a decade. You got I'm 55. I'll be 56 in August, but you got a few years on me. But let me ask you this: what compelled an 11-year-old to go see Diary of a Mad Housewife?
Because it was playing in one of the theaters that showed the lower budget, fringier films. And that one was inexpensive to get into. I believe it was like a dollar or that. So.
Okay. So it was the cheapest one to get into. That makes sense. Okay.
It's safe to go to the RKO Coliseum and watch the good movies. So, you know, you go to one of the other theaters that had the, you know, fringier, more raunchy type of movies and watch movies there. And they usually showed more than one movie. So, you know, you could spend an entire afternoon there on a weekend or after school. And there you go.
Well, and, you know, I mean, for that time period and for your age, that would have been a little racy because, as I recall, there is a little bit of nudity here and there.
Yeah, there's a little bit of nudity
in it. What's refreshing about it is that it's, you know, nudity done by, you know, somebody who was chosen, you know, for her acting talents as opposed to the way she looked. So there's something more natural about it, you know, for me. Anyway, it doesn't seem, you know, tawdry or dirty or anything like that in the least. It just seems natural, you know, normal. Not no exploitation. I guess that's probably the direction. I don't want to sound like a big prude because I'm not. There's just something almost wholesome about it in a way.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that's not quite the word I'm looking for, but certainly normal.
More natural.
Healthy. Healthy maybe is the word I'm looking for.
And that's where I saw Andy Warhol's Dracula and Frankenstein.
Wow. I love both of those. Those are great movies.
Yes, yes. And the 3D was done really, really well, you know, with the spear with the internal organs dangling from it right in front of your face, and the bats that were flying around and would occasionally hover in front of you. It was, again, very well done.
But you would have been still really young to have seen those. I mean, those were, I don't want to say they're not raunchy, but back then, they in some communities would have been seen as pretty raunchy films. I mean, you know, with D'Alessandro, you know, especially the Dracula one, which is kind of raunchy, really. but both of those films are great. And as a teenager, you know, let's say VCR, I had no way of seeing them, so I had just read about them. And early on, when video cassette rentals started to gin up, they hit one of our then local stores, and I rented them both. And I was probably, I don't know, like 17 or so, and and without the 3D, you know, unfortunately. But they blew my mind. They are incredibly inexpensively produced, but fascinating. You can't stop watching it. You got to wait until the end. They are amazing movies, both of them.
Oh, most certainly, and they owe everything to the Hammer films, more so than to Universal, because Hammer was creative with the source material and did something, less expensive, yes, but much more vibrant the Universal movies were classics. They were icons. They were archetypes, you know, whereas the Hammer movies were very much alive.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. And Udo Kier in Andy Warhol's Dracula is just amazing. he's a really good actor anyway. He's just fantastic. But here he is in this really inexpensive small picture, and he is chewing on the sets. And given the best performance he can, he is just amazing in that movie.
We still tend to, you know, if something has Udo in it, we'll watch it just because it's in it.
Well, he's a really good actor. But I mean, he you know, camps it up a little bit in Dracula, but how could you not? You know, you're in an Andy Warhol movie. I mean, you got to pull a show, you know. And he's just brilliant in it. He's so good. And I know that Joe D'Alessandro is supposed to be the star of the movie, but for me, even the first time I watched it, I was just watching Udo Kier, you know, as the Dracula, as the vampire, I should say, because he's just fantastic in it.
Almost certainly so.
And you know, I'd seen some of Andy Warhol's other dabblings in film. It's a shame that I'm glad that he had did the films that he did. I think I've seen most of them, you know, at this point. Probably have copies of most of them now that I think about it. But it's a shame that there wasn't a little more output there. But I guess that makes what he did produce maybe a little more precious.
I would agree.
And are you familiar with an actress named Mary Warrenoff? She's been in a lot of horror and science fiction movies since the 70s, I guess would probably be her
big decade. The name rings a bell, but my wife is the one who knows all the actors and their filmographies. I unfortunately do not, but that name rings a bell, so I'm sure I've come across it.
Okay.
I'll Google
her. Did you ever watch a Paul Bartel movie called Eating Raoul?
Yes.
Okay, she is Paul Bartel's wife in the movie.
She's
Mary. Okay, that's Mary Warrenoff.
Okay.
Anyway, she came out of the Warhol factory. She's a product of that. And it's kind of interesting that she wound up, making dozens and dozens of horror films. I mean, she's been Eating Raoul is a comedy. Obviously, it's not a horror film.
Yeah.
She can do she can do mean, she can do innocent, evil, she can work the spectrum of characters in it. She's best when she's evil, I think. For any good actor, I think if they can pull off a role where they're just despicable, And do it so well. I think that's the sign of a good quality actor. Somebody who knows how to emote. They know how to draw from the well of their emotions. And she's just fantastic at it. And she got her training at the Warhol Studio. So I think it's very interesting. And it kind of blurs the lines of art and. What's considered good cinema and what's considered bad cinema.
And how difficult it is to draw that line sometimes. Some things that just don't get great, like Plan 9 from Outer Space comes to mind.
Well, years and years ago, not too long after I started the drive-in, I was somebody who was a frequent visitor of my site. He was emailing me and I think he was working on a dissertation, quite honestly, because he just kept pumping me for information and we want sources, the names of sources. But he asked me to define what a B movie was. And he seemed to be under the impression that B stood for bad. And I gave him my, paragraph definition. I didn't go in too in depth, but I gave him a paragraph or so on what a B-movie was, and that it merely referred to how much money was spent on it. And sometimes, you know, even an A picture, if it's got B actors in it, kind of that kind of muddies the waters some. And there are some great A pictures with practically all B, you know, casts. But it's a really good ensemble, and there's a lot of them, you know. And those are always great movies and probably fairly quick to produce because B actors tend not to flub lines because you didn't really have that luxury.
Right.
You know, so maybe it wasn't the best read, but it wasn't flubbed. So. That's a talent in and of itself, though.
Yeah,
you know.
It reminds me of Johnny Depp as oh God, I'm drawing a blank on his name, Ed Wood, in the Ed Wood movie.
Mm-hmm.
He would just accept the first thing they filmed. And they move on to the next scene.
But you know that was true for some of the directors back then, and you only had 3 days, you know, to get a movie done. So, you know, anything that you got on film, you were going to print, you know, unless, you know, the set fell apart or somebody fell or something like that, because there was no money. You didn't have any money for more, you know, film stock, so you couldn't even waste that. And you had all these people on the crew, and, you know, if you went one day over, that was probably going to break the budget, the budget for the movie. So you had to get it done, and whatever printed that day was what you were going to edit into the final product. But that also means that, you know, you were probably trying, you know, the actors and, you know, the crew and everybody was probably trying to get it right the first time, and that shows a lot of heart. There's a lot of soul in that. That's hard to do. You know, if you know you can do 60, if you can do this take 60 times, well, you might not be so great most of the time that you're doing it. But if you're in a B movie, you better make it good because this is the one they're going to print.
Like if you're in a play, you have to get it right. When you're on the stage, you have to recover if you get it wrong.
Yeah, and you know, people with a lot of stage experience were naturals, you know, for things like that because they could, you know, pick up a script really fast and learn it and then, you know, spew it back at you. So if one of the other actors started to flub a line, you know, like old soap operas, you know, when we were kids in the 60s and 70s, they didn't have time to stop. You know, sometimes they were doing it live. You know, especially if something went wrong with you know, the videotape or something. So, if one person flubbed a line, it was up to the other actor to be able to, you know, pull things back, you know, into focus, get back on script, try to come up with something fast so that so it didn't look like the other actor, you know, flubbed a line.
And what many people don't realize is how many films are made that never get shown.
That's true. You have to have a distributor. You have to have an audience. That's kind of the first thing that you need. That's a very good point.
I remember during the heyday of my Fringe television show, I was very much in demand to be in people's like independent movies. And some of them seemed to have, you know, like backing. And I was kind of like a Where's Waldo? It's like, where's Thor the Barbarian? I'd be somewhere in the scene. And they usually give me something, you know, to do during that scene, you know, very brief. But I was in so many of those films. I don't think any of them ever came out. And then I almost made it into a trauma film. They did a lot of filming.
Oh, wow.
Then the producer changed. And then the new producer brought in all this money and they changed the show. That was Tales from the Crapper that I was supposed to be in. And then they wanted to cast as the colonel in Poultrygeist, but I think I was moving to Pennsylvania.
Oh, wow.
And I just couldn't make the journey back and forth and pay bills and things like that. So I had to pass on that.
Well, that's a shame because, I mean, Poultrygeist, that's actually one of Lloyd Kaufman's better known titles. that would have been really impressive, Hercules. You should have done it.
Well, something that could have been but wasn't, and that's okay.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I've blown a couple of decent opportunities, you know, in the course of my lifetime, and Doesn't bother me a bit. whenever I'm faced with a choice, for better or for worse, I just, using whatever knowledge I have, I try to make the best, decision, and I try to do it as soon as I can. I don't let things linger.
I'm exactly the same.
Yeah, I'm going to check that box off my list. I'm going to move on. So let me just go ahead and make this decision right now. Which I guess means I would have been I would have been an effective B movie director.
Well, there's still life ahead of us. You never know. The way that it's getting really cheap to film things, and now you could add all sorts of effects from your camera.
That's true. Everybody in our country is a giant ham. Everybody thinks that, everybody's just waiting to be discovered. I guess maybe that's what I'm trying to say. And this whole country is like that. So you could probably come up with some talent pretty easily. You might even be able to auction off some parts to generate money for the production of the film. Yeah, you're right. One of the reasons why I'm trying to, although I enjoy what I do for a living, I'm trying to put the wraps on my career here pretty soon. I've got about 2 years until I've got my magical 30. Years in, and that's when I can retire and take my health insurance into Medicare age. So that's the last shoe to hit the floor for me. It's just kind of locking that in. And you're right. I do want to explore, for the next 20 years or so of my life, I do want to explore some things that I want to do. And the technology is just cheaper and cheaper all the time, and it's better and better. You can make a movie, if you have to make any kind of investment at all into the equipment, it's just going to be a few hundred dollars plus some software and a decent – and you probably already have a decent PC or a Mac so that you can run the software. It just takes learning it, or you can hand the whole project over to a 19-year-old who's fairly tech savvy and, give him, $1,000 or something like that and get it done. You just have to have a really good story. I mean, that kind of goes back to every film. If there's no story, or if the script just isn't there, there's really not going to be a film. It's not going to be much fun, unless it's all done improv, and then, if it's one of the Christopher Guest, Michael McKean movies, mostly improv. I think they do work from outlines and things like that. But yeah, I'll watch those. I've seen all of those, and I thought they were all brilliant. It's a shame they stopped making them.
When I did my movie, it was mostly improv. It was a documentary of what was happening, so a lot of it was things as they transpired. But then we went and shot things and put them in the movie to make it a better movie. So it was all about when we went to Lake Placid. The show was dead, I think, because of September 11th. All the advertisers we had pulled out. Nobody knew what was going to happen. And I got invited by the Lake Placid Film Festival as media. So I had no show at the time. I had no people. I had no money. So it's all right. So they said, "Can you do it?" I said, "Yeah, sure." And it's how many people are you bringing? I said, around 12. So that gave me a mad scramble for a week to find 12 people, most of whom I did not know. And we filmed a 7-minute movie while we were there, and Lloyd Kaufman showed it. So we made a movie about us at the film festival that got shown during the film festival. And then I had my crew for season 3, I think, or season 2. I don't remember which season it was. But that was insane. And we got more news coverage than the film festival got in Lake Placid. So it was really, really cool.
But there's something to be said for that, that sort of guerrilla style of filmmaking, which has been done before and very effectively. And, if you can, turn a movie out, while, the historical event is happening, the more is the better. And, it's another nice thing about the technology, too. It's so small that you can, permit schmermit. I'll just shoot this on my iPhone and then move it over a little later and edit it. That's perfect. You don't have to shut down, a city street and you pay obscene permit fees and such. You can just do it there.
Do it.
And, if you don't get caught, it's sort of like the old, the old rhetorical question, if a tree falls in the woods and no one is there to hear it, does it make a sound?
Very, very, very true. Dr. Barbara Becker-Holton, she has a show on the channel. She and I did like all this weird television back in the day. She's still doing productions. I've stopped, obviously, except for podcasting. But she's like pioneering like selfie movies and now Zoom dramas. So I think it's very exciting. And this technology is used in a certain way. But what if you used it in a different way? Barbara's been experimenting with that, trying to, to do something different with something that's very familiar.
Well, and then it brings up another, interesting point. I think the technology now, along with, social media, of course, for better or for worse, it is sort of the defining feature, of the 21st century, really. It's had more effect, on how we interact than anything else. It's made people's attention spans very short, and as a result, movies can be very short. I mean,
right.
Like TikTok videos, or you were talking seconds there, and you mentioned that you had done a 7-minute film,
right?
That Lloyd Kaufman ran, and YouTube videos, which are usually anywhere from about 3 to 25, 30 minutes in length. You're not necessarily bound anymore by, having to turn out a 90-minute horror film, let's say. You can make it any length you want.
Right.
And I think that's another beauty of the really affordable and high-quality equipment that you can get now. And then, if you compare that to being able to publish it yourself as quickly as you want and then putting it out on, a social media platform like YouTube, which is exactly what YouTube is, you've removed a lot of barriers. It's always wonderful if you don't have to have a middleman.
Right.
You don't have somebody standing between you and what you want to do. Which is to release your film. YouTube's great because you can put it up there yourself. You're probably not going to make any money, unless you become an influencer or you're semi famous or famous or infamous. Maybe that's probably the best way to go with it. But you can certainly get it out there. Maybe get a few likes.
Oh, certainly. And again, now there's GoFundMe and all sorts of other things. So if you're going to do a bigger project, if you can get somebody
there
to do some work, you can put it up there and people might pay for you to make it.
Well, since the last time we talked about science fiction and horror films, Joel Hodgson from Mystery Science Theater 3000 announced a Kickstarter campaign for sort of the next or new direction for Mystery Science Theater. In essence, they don't want to be bound to a particular platform. And the last two seasons were on Netflix, for example, and then Netflix canceled them. And before that, they were canceled by the Sci-Fi Network. And before that, they'd been canceled by Comedy Central. So they're just going to build their own kind of paywall, their own platform, which I think is really smart. And I noticed that people on social media, some of the old fans, and I've been a fan of Mystery Science Theater for 30, some odd years. Some of the old fans were just complaining like crazy about it. And I thought, well, no, this is the most direct way that you can support the kind of entertainment that you want.
Right.
Why wouldn't you contribute a few dollars? I see nothing wrong with that at all.
No, nor do
I, as a matter of fact, I think that's better, than, you're watching, you know, some of the free stuff that some big conglomerate, you know, has made. Not for the sake of art either. They're making it just as a contractual obligation so that, you know, soap companies will advertise with them. I'd rather just pay the performer.
And speaking of paying performers, I saw a mini thing somewhere. I don't remember where I saw it. It might have been on YouTube. It might have been somewhere else. But they now the technology to make like puppets out of people. So you can have like anybody who's on film and talk through some technology, and you could talk through their mouth. So it looks like the real person. And it doesn't look 100%, it looks maybe 95%, you know, not suspicious. So they're saying that's going to be affordable in a few years. So you could even take long expired horror movie actors and put them, you know, in productions. I see that happening. You know, now they're doing it like Disney's done it really well with Star Wars. That technology is going to be something that anybody can have in a very short period of time.
Or you can take a public domain movie and you could completely erase the soundtrack and dub it. You know, something like What's Up, Tiger Lily, the Woody Allen film where he had taken this Japanese kind of Euro spy, well, I guess Asian spy movie, and gave it this fantastic new soundtrack. You know, with Louise Lasser is one of the, who was his wife at the time, is one of the actors in it. And it's just brilliantly done. It's the corniest movie ever, and every time I watch it, I laugh out loud. It is so funny.
Well, when you retire and you're doing what you want, now you have a lot of ways of doing what you want. And that'll be extremely awesome because you have a lifetime full of contemplating these things and becoming familiar with them from a lot of different angles and building shrines to them. So what you'll bring to it will be amazing.
What will be amazing is actually having the time to maybe try to pull off something. You know how it is when you work, it just consumes your life. You know, I work in academia, and although I really like my job, it is a huge time suck. You know, I wake up in the morning, and, you know, before 6 o'clock in the morning, I'm doing stuff for work at home, you know, and I get emails from students at 10 o'clock at night and I'm answering them. It's just like you're always working. And I kind of need my own free time, you know, and the way things are run now, the what's expected of you in the workplace is insane. And I'm going to need to take a break from it for a while here in a couple of years, and it's going to be welcome. I'm not saying I'll never work again because, you know, that's possible. But if I do, I want it to be something fun. I want it to be something that I want to do.
And that's an excellent place to end tonight's show. We have less than
yes, it is.
And if you can kindly share how people can find you and send you emails and interact with you, that'd be great.
And revel in my lack of work ethic, apparently. But you could visit me online at briansdriveintheater.com. That's Brian with an I. More than 300 B-movie actors and actresses are profiled. It's a fun way to spend the day. Lots of public domain movies that you can watch directly from the drive-in as well as in addition to a movie of the day that changes every day. And if you want to interact with me social media-wise, find me on Facebook at Brian's Drive-In Theater if you want to search. I'm also on Twitter, but I'm a lurker on Twitter, so I don't post anymore, but I might, you know, retweet somebody or like a particular post. But that's about all I do these days on Twitter.
Thank you so much, Brian. As always, I had a great time, and I look forward to later in the month when we're doing our Steve Reeves special.
April 30th.
Be well, my friend, and thank you, and thanks to everybody who tuned in, whether you tuned in live or you'll be listening later on demand. Until next time, this is us wishing you joyous journeys and amazing adventures. Take care, everybody.